What is up, everybody? Welcome to the first episode of the Adjacent Hex podcast. My name is Zach. I'll be one of your co-hosts on the show, and I'm joined, as with every month here, by Doug. Doug, what have you been up to lately?
Actually, I've been going to a lot of movies. I've saw Ex Machina. I went and saw The Avengers so that my nerd card wasn't revoked.
Yeah, I saw that one too.
Yeah, I think everybody has seen The Avengers over the past weekend.
At least any self-respecting nerd, yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of a must-see. What else am I doing? Oh, big one. This Wednesday, you know, while we're recording, Zach and I are actually going to see the riff tracks, the live riff tracks of Tommy Wiseau's The Room.
Oh, good old Tommy Wiseau. And I think your wife hasn't seen it yet.
No, she has not seen it. We got a couple other friends of ours going. None of them have seen it.
Oh, boy. They are in for a treat, let me tell you.
Yeah. Zach introduced me to the film. I mean, I'd heard the myth, but we watched it a couple weeks ago and my mind was blown.
It occurs to me that you kind of didn't leave that, like, what the heck is going on position from the couch, like, the whole time we were watching.
Yeah, well, I still haven't left that position when it comes to that film. But that's it. I've been, you know, lots of movies for some reason. How about you?
I've actually been running a bunch of very cool events at various comic book and board game stores around the state. This past weekend, at time of recording, we had Free Comic Book Day out at Jetpack Comics in Rochester, New Hampshire. Some good friends of ours. We had the writer-illustrator for the comic Mouse Guard, which I believe has a board game attached to it.
Yeah, it was Kickstarted. It came out a couple months ago, last fall. August, I want to say.
Yeah, we haven't had a chance to play that one yet, but I'm sure we'll be talking about it in weeks to come. A few weeks ago, we also had International Tabletop Day, which was really, really sweet. It's put on by Geek & Sundry every year. They do a bunch of very cool events at local stores. We were hanging out at Collectibles Unlimited. Did you get to play any Tabletop Day events?
Yeah, I actually got over to my buddy John's house, and we had sort of an all-day tabletop thing. We used to work together and, you know, eat food, drink, play games. I got to play Star Realms.
Star Realms is sick. Yeah. I absolutely love that game. I actually just picked up the mobile version of it, and I've been playing all the time with Eric and Joff, a couple of our friends, as well as a couple other people. Our friend's nail technician, I guess, has been playing a lot with us.
Her title.
Yeah. The group nail technician.
As if any of us, except for Megan, you know, actually see her as a nail technician. But no, we've been playing with the recently expanded version, the Gambit set, which adds a set of cards that allow you to have a spontaneous or passive ability added to your card pool every single turn. So if I need an extra 3 attack to finish off an opponent or something like that, I have potentially the ability to have that on board when I go to make my attacks against my opponent. In fact, I completely demolished our friend Joff a couple of times just using those Gambit cards.
Yeah, I haven't got to play Joff yet. I've heard he's sort of a base hog. He really likes to buy up, scoop those up. And I now that I've played, I know what that means. When I played, I did not play well. My wife crushed me, like, an embarrassing display, you know, on my part.
I find that that game has a lot of potential for just crushing embarrassing losses. And you start going through... it's designed by former professional Magic the Gathering players, so it has a lot of similarities. It is. So it has a lot of technical similarities to that, and I find that when I lose a game, I have a tendency to go back and start picking apart where did I go wrong, what were my mistakes. The unfortunate part is where in Magic I can kind of learn from those mistakes. In Star Realms, I have a tough time putting that together.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. Especially when the Gambit set comes into play. Because you can use those gambits anytime during the game, and sometimes you're just like, well, did I use that too early, or did I come across it a little bit late?
Right, right.
So.
Yeah. So I got to play Star Realms.
Star Realms is an absolutely amazing.
I bought it. I hadn't played it yet. Everybody we know owns it.
Yeah.
So it's right up my alley. So I decided to pick it up. And I bought like four of the expansions right away.
Oh, the ones that just expand the base deck?
The base deck expansions, I guess. And I had a real good time with it, despite being absolutely destroyed.
Yeah.
But I think that's a sign of a good game. If you get killed and you still want to come back and try it again.
Absolutely. I mean, on the Drive to Work podcast, Mark Rosewater, the head designer, I believe, for Magic the Gathering, talks about communications theory. And one of the things he talks about is if your game promotes coming back and playing it again, even if you get harrowingly defeated, is the mark of a well-designed game.
Well, I've heard good things. I enjoyed it. I'll try it again.
Excellent. Yeah. What else did you play?
I got to play Dead of Winter. That game has been getting lots of play in my group. I've been able to teach people who've wanted to play it, have heard the buzz, and never got to.
Yeah.
So I've been sort of playing it around, and my buddy John, like I said, we were at his house, and it's a good game for five people. You can teach it really quick. It seems kind of like it's going to be overwhelming at first, but all these rules fit together really nicely. And this is a good time to bring up the Felicia Day Tabletop Day promo.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing to, transition into. During Tabletop Day, Geek & Sundry released a set of some very bizarre and potentially game-breaking promos. Why don't you go ahead and talk about that one?
Game-breaking is so extreme, but she seems like such a tough character, like a great character. For people who are familiar with the game, it's Felicia Day actress. Her likeness is on the card. It comes with a standee. She's got a really high, whatever that number in the top right corner is, influence number or whatever it is. It's like 53.
That's absurd.
Yeah, it's very high. For people who know, people know this, I think, but when the zombie bite strikes and it starts to spread throughout the colony, the lower your number, the more likely you are to die, because it starts at the bottom, works its way up. So a 53 doesn't guarantee she's going to stick around, but if she's in a room full of people or at the colony, that's a really solid number.
Which I guess from a flavor standpoint is actually pretty good, based on the fact that, like, she, if you know Felicia Day's story at all, she started from basically nothing, ostensibly, and has grown to be a fairly influential figure in the realm of Hollywood. So she persists.
From a nerd perspective, completely. Yeah, yeah, she's over there producing it. Whatever, we'll stop promoting Felicia Day. But she has great stats otherwise. In the game, you use the dice and you need to meet or beat a certain number, whether it's fighting zombies, searching for items, whatever. And she has 2 and 2, which makes her very, very good regardless of what you're trying to do.
I was going to say, that sounds like you're pretty much just going to hit it every single time.
And she's not the only character like that. There are a lot of characters who have great stats, 2s and 3s and that sorts of stuff, but they really made Felicia a character that is going to stick around and be very useful in the game.
I mean, one of the things I've really enjoyed about Dead of Winter is it is fairly accessible no matter what character you get stuck with. You can pretty much keep a character around if you want to. But some of the characters are just not quite that resilient.
Yeah, well, and if anybody moving rolls that tooth, it's an instant kill unless you're Sparky the Wonder Dog, which is my favorite character.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, just load Sparky up with a shotgun and a med kit and blueprints to a building.
Yeah, and he can just wreck the game. Just get through it.
Sparky is the greatest. But yeah, her power is really interesting too, because everybody knows, anybody familiar with the game, and if you're not, that in the game, the person to your right of you on your turn draws what's called a crossroads card. And she does come with her own crossroads card, but these are very situational. It's like a group of people are showing up or you're walking through, and sometimes it says if a specific person is in the game, the crossroad triggers.
Right.
Her power is if one of those cards with a specific person comes up and they're not in the game, it triggers automatically because of her. I guess it's the whole actress thing. Because I have had those games where it's like, is this character out? No. Okay, nothing happens. Is this character out? No. And I guess she would sort of fix that. I don't want to say problem. I think that's too strong of a word.
I agree.
But that wouldn't really happen if she were out.
That's true. I feel like it makes the game a lot more both intense and not so much at the same time.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to play with her yet, and so, you know, maybe I can talk a little bit more when I've actually got to use her in play and see how it plays out, that sort of...
Yeah, I think we can bring her back up when we talk about promos and promo distribution in a few months here.
But I'm excited. The artwork looks great. I love the guys at Plaid Hat. They're great people. Own a lot of their games, play a lot of their games. So
yeah, I've had nothing but positive interactions with Plaid Hat.
I've never heard a bad thing about Plaid Hat, and so... So I got that card. I haven't played it yet. The other thing I got to play was Betrayal at the House on the Hill.
Now, see, I've heard really polarized things about that game. I've heard that some of the scenarios are just not as well put together as others. Is that the experience you had?
This was my second. I got to play it right when it came out, way back in the day, the first edition. And it was fun, but the way our scenario turned out, the Betrayer... won way too easily.
Oh, really?
It was my first time playing. Maybe I didn't prepare. I didn't know what was coming. But it was something like escape the building, and two of us were in the attic, one person was in the basement, and he was on the main floor.
Right.
That's how I remember it. This was years ago. And he just sort of walked out of the building. And I don't know if it was...
That seems really...
Yeah, I don't even know if that's true, or if the guy who read the thing messed up or didn't know, but it wasn't great. But this time was much better. The playtime on the box said it was about an hour. It took us about an hour and a half to two. But
well,
we didn't have a betrayal, which was interesting.
That is interesting. Yeah. I mean, you expect there to be one based on the title of the game.
Yeah, yeah.
I kind of like that, though. Going back to what we were talking about a little while ago about communications theory, one of the things that makes a good game is when the element of surprise in the game is particularly strong. When the players are taken for a loop and something that they expect to happen maybe doesn't, or something they don't expect does.
Yeah, well, that's what happened here. We ended up all fighting our evil twins. We had to have a certain item and stuff, and we had to pass it around and work together, and it was difficult but manageable, and we ended up winning the game.
That's awesome.
Everybody won. Where you sort of expect that transition to everybody versus one. Never happened.
That's really cool. I love games where you can kind of work together with the people you're playing with, whether it's actually a cooperative game or just a game that has a cooperative aspect.
Yeah.
I actually spent my tabletop day playing almost exclusively cooperative games.
Co-ops?
Yeah. I mean, that's it is well documented amongst our group of friends that I am the cooperative gamer. I don't like playing competitively. Mostly because the drive to win amongst our friends is particularly strong. We have a couple of buddies who, you know, have competed on the Pro Tour at Magic the Gathering, and are just like, that's what they want to do. It's just win every single time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not like that.
That power gamer mentality.
Exactly. And to that end, you know, we have alpha gamers and stuff like that. You know, I tend to use the analogy of Warhammer players. Warhammer players tend to be alpha gamers. They want to win, and they want everybody else to see their line of thinking. But in a cooperative environment, you don't have that pitfall, I guess. There are some games that still lend themselves to like one person being like, "Oh, well, this I know what this player does. They should be doing this."
And not
that sort of director of the table.
And we have a couple of those in our playgroup as well, but I think the difference is that they're aware of it. And so they can sort of start to rein themselves in if the group says, let me do my own thing, right?
Yeah, well, I think we also have a good group who will be like, that's good advice, but not really what I was going to do, and I'm just going to sort of do my own thing anyway.
Which is interesting, because I remember the first time you and I played Dead of Winter, we had someone like that.
Who got us all killed.
Exactly. Her side quest or whatever to win the game for her was, I believe, to hoard food?
Yeah, finish the game with X amount of food.
It screwed us all up, because...
We starved to death.
We did starve to death, and we're all expecting, okay, we've got clearly enough food to last this out going around the table, and all of a sudden it kind of just disappeared.
Well, once you get those starve tokens, and then every round your morale is just dropping, and that is very hard to recover from.
It absolutely is.
It's really hard to recover from. Yeah, that's an interesting game, because it's kind of cooperative.
Right. It's like backstabby cooperative goodness. The games that I really gravitate toward and the ones we played a lot at Tabletop Day were Forbidden Desert, which I adore. The strategy in that game is fantastic.
Did you ever win?
All the time. Yeah. I've actually only lost one game of Forbidden Desert ever. And the reason Doug that asks this is because, notoriously, it is a very difficult game to actually be successful at.
What level are you playing?
Just novice. I mean, and that's probably what makes the difference.
Although I think even on novice, it's a challenge.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, once you get enough of those Storm Picks Up cards, making it more and more difficult to A, keep ahead of the storm, and B, uncover the various tiles that are moving around, you get into trouble pretty quickly. I think what's made it most successful for us is those of us who have played it several times have started to understand better the roles that the characters take.
Yeah, I think you really need to play to your character's strength mm-hmm. in that game. You can't just ignore it or let it go. Like, if you're yellow, who's he, the pilot?
I believe so.
Navigator, maybe? Whatever he is. Can move somebody 3 spaces for 1 action. Like, that's 3 of anybody else's. You need to use that.
Right.
A black character can carry people through and over sand dunes.
Yeah, the climber or whatever. And those are actually 2 of the key characters that we had when we were playing on Tabletop Day. We had those. We had the water carrier.
You need the water.
You can't win a game. You don't even have a chance if you don't have the water carrier. I suppose you can really start to strategize, okay, here's a potential water tile, and get everybody there before you flip it. But that just doesn't reliably give you the quantity of water that you need to survive that game.
Yeah. No, it doesn't. It absolutely doesn't. The water character is... I think, is the rule you randomly...
That is one way to play it.
Designate? We never do that. We always pick.
Yeah, I think most playgroups that I've had the experience of playing with have just assigned, okay, this is the character that I associate with the most or understand the best. I usually pick the green character who has the ability to move diagonally.
So do I.
Yeah, that's why you and I kind of butt heads on that one. Yeah, fortunately, your wife is always like, oh yeah, I'll pick the water carrier.
She likes the blue carrier.
Yeah. At that point, I often pick either the red or yellow characters. The red character having the ability to clean sand blown by the storm off of more tiles. As the
game. He can do 2 for 1.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. That's a great game.
It really is.
I still like Forbidden Island.
I've only played Forbidden Island once. Yeah. It's a very similar game, for those who aren't aware, in that the tiles are still moving around and the water level is actually...
Well, the tiles don't move. The flood rises and, like,
that's
get flipped over and go away.
That's right.
The only reason I brought it up is a lot of people, once Forbidden Desert came out, it replaced Forbidden Island for them. I like to play them both still. And it actually, if you've got the time to play them back-to-back and do a little narrative, it's kind of...
Yeah, it actually is kind of clever that they sort of... The characters' roles are similar enough that you can be like, oh, well, this is the same engineering or exploration team that was in the first game. And I'd honestly like to see a third part to that board game system. I really like the rules, and I like the way that the story kind of drives itself. Although, if it is the same adventuring team, they are the most haphazard team in the world.
It would be... Not somebody I would sign up with. Do you know if he's... I mean, I haven't looked into it at all. Have you ever heard, is there a third that he's working on? Or?
Not that I'm aware of. The designer of that game, I believe, is Matt Leacock.
Matt Leacock, same guy who did Pan...
That's what I was just going to say. He's a big name in the world of cooperative gaming. He did Pandemic and Pandemic the Cure, which are also games that I've played recently, cooperative, both of them. The problem that I have with those is, of course, that alpha gamer mentality, because those are both games where the decisions that go on aren't necessarily made by the group. They're more often made by whoever's played it the most or whoever's the most familiar with that kind of game. Pandemic the Cure, which is a dice-based version of the original Pandemic, has less of that, but it's still, like, I found myself basically doing nothing when I played that game and letting the group around me sort of be like, oh, well, you need to roll this on so many dice, and if you don't, you're a scumbag.
Would you recommend The Cure?
Absolutely. Don't get me wrong, both games very, very fun.
I haven't actually played either Pandemic or The Cure.
Yeah, it's... So basically the premise is you're a group of scientists, sort of globetrotters, I guess. Mm-hmm. Your objective is to isolate different strains of bacteria that have broken out across the globe, research a cure for it, and then distribute the cure.
Right.
And from a flavor standpoint, that's incredibly strong. It gives it a very World War II, maybe a little bit later than that, feel to it. Just
like one of those 1950s sort of outbreak.
Exactly.
Well, not an outbreak, like monster movies, but it's got the...
Yeah.
All the different people working together type.
Exactly, a Manhattan Project kind of thing, which is also another good game, but we'll get into that later. The other game that I was particularly fond of at Tabletop Day and have been playing a lot of lately is Tiny Epic Defenders. It's the second game in the Tiny Epic series, created by Scott Alms and Michael Coe, collectively known as Gamelin Games. And we have been playing a ton of that lately. It basically, you are, at this point in the game, a fantasy race of your choosing. Dwarfs, elves, lizardmen, centaurs, what have you. And your job is to, in the first game, establish a civilization. That's Tiny Epic Kingdoms. And that is a competitive game. But I'm more fond of the sequel to that, Tiny Epic Defenders, where your job is actually to defend your city against a horde of monsters and eventually, if you survive that long, a big bad. Basically, the game functions with three decks of cards and a group of tiles where your characters move around and defend the tiles, each one representing a different location around that central city that you presumably built in that first game.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how the reviews are. I know Tom Vassell in the Dice Tower, I think he gave it a 4 out of 10, and I don't agree with that at all.
I don't either. I don't know why it's been rating so slowly, or so lowly.
Well, I don't know if that's universal. I just know that's what he gave it. I haven't seen a lot of other reviews. But I just... The games I have played, I have had so many nail-biters where making good decisions...
As a group.
Was make... Yeah, it just made or break. You won or you lost based on those decisions. And either way, it was really close. And I've just been a fan of every game I've played of that, except the one where I messed up the ruse horribly for everybody.
Yeah, Doug made the mistake of putting all the enemies that were possible to put in the deck.
Yeah, and I didn't build them in. Like, you're supposed to add a card after every round. You add another card to the deck of the villain cards that you're flipping. Yeah. I just tossed them all in right at the beginning, and we're like, it's only round two and we've lost the game. Look, what?
Yeah.
But that was all me.
It
was terrible.
So I'm looking at the Board Game Geek ratings right now, and it's sitting at about a 6, which is still...
That's not terrible.
That's not bad. It's still not as high as I feel about it. I really, really enjoy this game and will play it at any opportunity. Mostly because each character that you are able to play in the game has a unique ability to it.
Yeah.
The as I guess is to be expected, the Kickstarter promos are very, very good.
Yeah, the Gamelin Knight is one of them, right? Yes. He can defend from inside the city.
Yes.
Just so everybody knows, normally you have to be in a certain area in order to defend it from the oncoming monsters, but not the Gamelin Knight, not the
the big bad guy.
It's their logo, and yeah, he's just a character in the games, and he's just he doesn't break the game.
No, he doesn't, and that's
but he's really good to have.
Yeah, that's one of the things that really surprises me about the balancing that Michael and Scott have put into their product. They really understand that promos are not about busting the game.
Yeah.
They understand that promos are just something cool that will further the gaming experience.
Yeah, they should enhance. They shouldn't break or change so drastically. I'm not a fan of the Trump card, yeah. The Trump promo card. Yeah, look what I got, you didn't. No, I'm going to win every time.
Yeah, it becomes unfair at that point.
Yeah,
whereas the promos in Tiny Epic Defenders are balanced and just something cool that people are like, oh, well, I can play with this or not, you know, whatever happens to happen.
In my opinion, every promo should be that way. It should be, there should be no must-have promos.
Exactly.
That's just my personal opinion.
And we'll definitely get into that more as the podcast expands. We have a guest lined up in a few weeks, or a few months rather, who will talk on at great length, whether you want him to or not.
He is adamant about the...
Yeah, he really is. So we'll get into that in the future. Yeah, I mean, cooperative gaming is really a unique aspect of the board gaming hobby that I think people often overlook, because most of the games that we're exposed to as young people, things like Monopoly or Clue or the Game of Life, they all have a competitive aspect to them.
Yeah, there's very few games with that. Well, I think even the co-op in general is very modern, though, right? Last 15 years is when it's really taken off. It wasn't...
I agree, and I think that now that we're seeing more and more cooperative games, I'm wondering how that drives decisions of game makers in the future. For example, we see games out of companies like Greater Than Games. Most of their products, in fact, their three flagship products, Sentinels of the Multiverse, Sentinel Tactics, and Galactic Strike Force, are all...
Tactics is only semi. You do have that one...
That's true, and I was just about to get to that.
Yeah.
I like the fact that it's... The cooperative nature of some games coming out these days is driving a semi-cooperative environment, where you have either a team on another team or everybody against one person.
Oh, the group, like the Space Cadets Dice Duel does.
Yes.
You need like 4 to 8 people or something, because it's my whole team versus your whole team.
Exactly.
Which is something I haven't played yet. It's a relatively new... But I see what you're saying there with just sort of that expansion. Well, even Dead of Winter, you've had the traitor mechanic before with... You know, Battlestar Galactica and Shadows Over Camelot has that traitor mechanic in there. But Dead of Winter is really interesting because not only is there the potential for a traitor, just full-on traitor, but there's also those objectives that... the individual objectives that everybody has. So, like we mentioned before in that game, that person was not a traitor, but got everybody killed for selfish reasons.
Right.
And so it's really... Whereas in the Sentinels of the Multiverse, you can be selfish, but everybody is going after that villain. Everybody... And there's no hidden agenda anywhere.
Exactly. And I like the fact that some of the decks that are coming out now, most in particular Guy's, like, his selfish aspects are slightly more pronounced than some of the other characters. And I think that reflects a general change in the trend that game developers are starting to embrace that cooperative spirit and feed a little bit of competitiveness into each experience as well.
Well, there's also... I don't know if... Have you played CO2?
I have not.
okay, we'll have to play that because it is on my shelf. But CO2 is really interesting because it's got different phases of the game. Mm-hmm. It's not cooperative. There is a distinct winner at the end. It's every man for himself. But it starts off, the world is really polluted, coal and oil and that sort of stuff, and you're sort of transitioning to better forms of fuel. And at the end of every round, it's, you count up the damage done by fossil fuels, etc. And you have this track, and if you ever hit a certain point on the track, everybody dies, everybody loses. It's like the earth is beyond repair. So early game, everybody is sort of working together, disregarding what's the best move for themselves necessarily. Like, you're benefiting, but it might not be the best thing. But overall, it keeps the game going.
I really like that, in that it promotes teamwork, but at the same time, like you know, you have that impending doom where everybody can lose, but not everybody can win.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I really have enjoyed about Sentinel Tactics, is either that team of heroes wins, in the scenarios anyway, mm-hmm. And that one villain is like, well, what am I going to do? And
we've seen that before. Like, Descent is the same way, Mansions of Madness, that sort of game master type character versus, I mean, I learned it back in Hero Quest way back in the day, was really my intro to that sort of
right
system.
The thing I really like about that is you can say, all right, this player has a tendency to be that alpha gamer, like, I'm going to sort of guide everybody else's mm-hmm. decisions. And you can say to that person, okay, we want you to play the villain or the solo player. Yeah. And we're going to sit back and we're going to play the heroes, and we know more about working together or the context of the game or whatever it is. And then you can have both, you can have your cake and eating it too.
I think Sentinel's just the way it plays. You've got your own deck of cards in front of you. Mm-hmm. Whereas like a Pandemic or a Defenders of the Realm, everybody can see the board, and it's like, right, we need to go to this area and take care of this problem. You should do that. You're over here already. You need to do whatever. In Sentinels, I'm the only one who knows what I've got in my hand. So it's really I can share that information if I want to, but it's like, you need to attack now. Well, I've got something I can do better. I can buff everybody else. And I
like the fact that Sentinels promotes interaction where you're like, well, I can do X damage. Can anybody buff that? Or would it be more advantageous for me to draw two cards this turn?
Yeah, I feel in our group when we play, we do a lot of, we don't have that problem of, okay, you do this, you do this, you do this, that one person taking over. But we do have a lot of communication.
Oh, absolutely.
On the next turn, I can do this much damage, or I can do this. If somebody else can do damage, I can buff everybody else or heal everybody else.
Yeah.
Whatever it might be.
And it's that sort of situation that promotes awareness of the game state, knowing what's going on. It's useful to know, you know, some cards and some of the decks at that point, because you can think about, okay, Tempest has this ability to heal everyone and draw a card or something like that. I'm making that card up off the top of my head, but it's unique in that respect.
Yeah, well, it does a lot of stuff like that. It definitely helps to know the characters, and because there are certain combinations that play off each other really well. Mm-hmm. The last game we played, we actually had a problem because we did have a guys player. Jesse, my wife, was actually playing guys, and I was playing Night Mist. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing for guys to steal. Well, not a lot for guys to steal. A lot of what he does is take somebody else's ability for a short while and uses it as his own. But with hers, they're very specific to her, like play a spell card, heal. That's not going to help guys because he doesn't have any spell cards.
Right.
So there are, it helps to know the characters, but it doesn't mean that a person who does can control the game.
Right. And what worked out well in our favor in that case was I was running Omnitron X, yeah, I believe, and he has a lot of abilities that guys could target, and gank for a turn.
He's got that rocket fist.
Yeah, that rocket fist was sick.
Guys is taking that all the time.
Absolutely.
That's a cool game because, you know, we were just talking about, like, that, like, tactics. You've got the one person playing the villain and the descent and stuff, and it just takes that out. Game's the villain. Everybody gets to play together.
Right.
And it's fun. And the reason I bring that up is, like, I mean, it's kind of obvious, but I know my buddy Tom in college always got stuck in that villain role because he was willing to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, everybody else likes to play the hero. Some people like to play the villain, but he was willing to play the villain in a group of people wanting to play the heroes. And Sentinels just kind of plucked that character right away. I mean, if you like to play the villain.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's...
Maybe it's not for you, but... This game's great. Game's great.
And that's really the nature of cooperative gaming. You spend time with some friends. You want to have a good time. Whether you win or lose, you do it together. And that's really the bottom line. And, I mean, you play a few cooperative games, and generally speaking, you want to throw a competitive one in there just to get that, you know, let's duke it out. Let's have a fight here. And I think it's all about balance at that point.
Yeah.
You don't want to play too many cooperative games.
Unless you're playing Ghost Stories, in which it's very balanced.
Right.
100% you will lose.
Yeah.
No, I've beaten that game a few times, but that's a tough game. Tough game to win.
All right. Well, I think that's about good enough for tonight. If you want to find us, check out our website at anotherletdown.com. If you want to get a hold of us quickly, Twitter is the best place to do that. I am DENONCZD. And Doug, what's your Twitter handle?
It's okay to laugh. ITSOKTOLAFF. I had to remember that. I wasn't sure how to spell my own handle.
All right. So for all of us at the Adjacent Hex podcast, happy gaming. Adjacent Hex is recorded monthly by the staff of AnotherLetdown.com and edited by Jody Wagner.